Let's Talk with Anna Glavinsky.
Anna Glavinsky here, and I'm joined by Prit Butter, who's going to be talking about his book, which is called Into the Reich. Good morning, Prit. How are you doing today?
Good morning. I'm very well. How are you?
Yeah, great to have you. Well, I'm all right. I want to start with two things, actually. The first of all is that I'm doing a cover show today, so I'm covering for our usual presenter. So please bear with me if I haven't got as much prep about this really important time in history. I'll be asking questions, and if you can sort of like talk it through with us. But the other thing that I'd also like to mention is that my granddad, so my surname is Glavinsky, so we've got a Polish touch in our family. My granddad was from the Slonim region, which isn't to do with the particular battle and charge that you're talking about in your book, but it is an area that is sort of covered geographically in where you're talking about. And obviously it had a huge impact. We've heard so many stories from my granddad as we were growing up about the land that he basically lost. He was never able to go back there. And so it is sort of a time in history and a geographical place that I have a lot of interest in. So really looking forward to picking your brains this morning, and thank you for joining us.
It's great to be here. It's a very important point, though, regarding Poland, that for many people in Poland, and I imagine your family were part of this, the arrival of the Soviet forces was not really a liberation from the Nazis. It was more the replacement of one occupation by another. For them, okay, it was perhaps in many respects less overtly murderous than the Nazi regime, but it was by no means a restoration of pre-war Poland in any recognisable form.
I do remember specifically my granddad saying that because he got kicked out by the Russians, you know, packed off into a cattle truck and sent off into Siberia. And he was always grateful, though. He was like, I'm really glad it was the Russians that got us and not the Germans, because, like, you use the word murderous there. Yes. Only 1 in 10 people survived the journey that he went on, but he still was grateful for the odds that that gave him versus what he felt would have happened if it had been the Nazis.
Well, exactly. And although there is an understandable emphasis on the huge loss of life in the Soviet Union during the war, with over 20 million people dying, both soldiers and civilians combined. In terms of percentage loss of population, Poland suffered more than any other nation in the war. And I think sometimes that's rather overlooked, because with a smaller percentage, just simply because of the scale of the country, the Soviet Union records a much greater number of losses.
Wow, it is powerful. And what about you then? So what, you know, I've got my gentle interest. What about you? How come you're drawn specifically to this topic, and why this battle, and why this book?
My background is that I joined the army as a doctor out of medical school, started as a surgeon, and then became a GP. Then left the army, became a civilian GP, where at one point I had a patient who was an elderly German lady from what used to be East Prussia. And she told me her story of escaping from her homeland as the Red Army arrived. There were certain bits of her story that I wasn't familiar with, and I started just researching it. And in those days, my German was not particularly good. In order to understand the German accounts, I really had to translate them out. And I therefore almost ended up writing a book by accident and just accumulating a lot of material. I finally massaged it into a single book, which was my first book. But there was so much leftover material that then led to the next, and then the next, and so on. And now I've come to the stage where I've followed the war in the East through both world wars. This book describes the Soviet advance across what is now most of Poland. And next year there will be, if you like, the final installment of this story with an account of the Battle of Berlin. But it's been a long road, and it's been a fascinating road. And, you know, your own experience shows how what for many people is, if you like, just history, is just, you know, what they read in books. For other people, it's very much the living past of their own personal experiences or their family experiences. And I think as the generations grow older and pass on, it's very important to preserve as many of these personal stories as possible.
Yeah, I really agree with you, because I think, you know, as I've now got a kid who didn't know my granddad, and I do try and sort of share those stories with him, because, you know, that the horror of war and everything that went on in that time was very powerful in my life, even though I didn't experience it. And I think sharing those stories with the younger generations is really, really important if we don't want to sort of see it carrying on and being repeated. And I think that's what maybe sets your book apart from other history books, especially around this time, because you've got those firsthand testimonies. You're actually speaking to people who have put their stories into the book. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, some of their stories, how you got them, how you found the people, and all that sort of thing?
It's a very difficult thing, because memoirs and autobiographies, particularly of senior figures on both sides, can be very, very unreliable. An American historian a few years ago coined a superb expression when he said, pretty much any autobiography or memoir can be retitled as the story of a hero by one who knows him best. And, you know, that's very true of most of the memoirs that were written after the war. Also, the narrative of the fighting against the Soviet Union in the Second World War is unusual, in that the English language accounts that I grew up with certainly were very much history written by the losers, because by then the Soviet Union was a new enemy in the Cold War, and the German accounts that emerged in the 50s and 60s were generally accepted without any criticism and without any analysis. It's only much more recently that that's been challenged. Likewise with the Soviet accounts, they were so subject to censorship, to having to conform to the official Soviet view of how the war unfolded, that again, they're often unreliable. And the higher up the hierarchy you go, the less reliable they become. Finally, accounts written by Red Army veterans or interviews with Red Army veterans began to appear in the 1990s, which were perhaps a little bit more honest. But you're now inviting people to remember events from 40 years ago, and that adds another layer of obscurity and possible errors, either deliberate or accidental. And it's understandable that everybody wants their own part in great events to be portrayed in the best possible light. So it's very, very unusual to find accounts either by the Germans or the Soviets where they're actually honest about some of the terrible crimes that were committed by both armies as they moved back and forth across Europe. It's, you know, it's very easy for them to say, well, it wasn't my company that did that. It would have been another division or another regiment or whatever. And the truth is, you know, war does bring out the worst in everybody, and I think it's always worth scratching beneath the surface of all of these accounts to try to understand the actual reality of what it was like. So actually picking these accounts can be really, really difficult. It's by no means an easy task.
And so how did you do that? And then how did you discern the information picking out what you did?
Well, wherever possible, you try to get corroboration. So if you get an account by one side saying, you know, we fought this heroic battle and we destroyed, you know, some improbable number of enemy tanks and captured all of these prisoners. And then you look at the other side's account and they record something like, well, we lost two tanks and one of those got stuck in the mud or something. You know that one side or the other is actually not telling the truth. And then you have to start looking at how the reports were compiled at the time, which then gives you a clue as to where the unreliability comes. And the answer is usually both sides are not telling you the truth. And you have to try to, you know, pick your way through that. It isn't easy by any means, and wherever possible, I have tried just to present the words of the people who were involved and leave readers to make their own minds up about the accuracy, the honesty of these accounts. And I think some of them are, you know, some of them will say, you know, some of the interviews of the Soviet veterans were very honest in some respects, at least, when they said, when they were asked about the atrocities committed by the Red Army, and many of them just said, I don't really want to talk about that. All I will say is that anything that we did was not comparable to what the Germans did to us. And, you know, I'm sure the Germans would have said very, very similar. But at least there is, if you like, a tacit admission there that terrible things did occur.
Yeah, yeah, understandable. You know, and I guess admission as well. You know, how much did you actually have a hand in playing in doing horrible things? I can understand why people would not feel comfortable talking about it. So, you know, well done for sort of getting these accounts out there. And also, if you could just talk us through a little bit of the timeline, that story, just in very sort of geographical and time-sensitive terms, what does your book cover?
Sure. So this starts in the Great Advance starts in January 1945. The Battle of the Bulge in the West is pretty much over. The Germans are being driven out of the territory they still hold on the west bank of the Rhine, and the Western Allies are preparing to penetrate into Germany. The previous autumn, the Soviet Union had reached roughly the line of the Middle Vistula River. So they're deployed across what historically would have been roughly central Poland, but now we regard as being more eastern Poland. And in January, they launched this massive offensive where they sweep across the river and then advance across the frozen landscape at a pace that the Germans just can't deal with. The German losses in the previous year had been so heavy that although they had constructed a front line, it really wasn't anything more than a crust. And as soon as that crust broke, the Red Army had just advanced freely. Their advance just sweeps away the Germans. It overruns many of the terrible concentration camps, Auschwitz and the satellite camps, etc. And for Stalin, the aim is to move as far west as possible, as quickly as possible, because at this stage, he is still paranoid about perhaps the British and the Americans will not fulfill their obligations. After all, they are evil imperialists. They may sign up with the Germans against us. So if I want my vision of the future of Europe to become reality, it's important that the Red Army controls as much of Europe as possible. In particular, he's very keen on reaching Silesia, which is the last productive industrial part of Germany, knocking that out, because after that, Germany really can't carry on resisting. But ultimately, of course, the aim is Berlin. And he's very aware that if the British and Americans come to some sort of understanding with the Germans, they might get to Berlin first, and that's really not acceptable to him.
And so you're making it clear that, you know, their mission is to take control of as much land as possible. But you also mentioned the sort of coming across and liberating of the Auschwitz concentration camps. Could you just tell us a little bit about that in more detail? I know it wasn't sort of the main objective, but it can't be ignored.
No, of course not. And I think one of the most poignant memoirs I came across was from a Soviet pilot who was flying ground attack missions. And he said on one particular day, we were ordered to fly over this German town and bomb the railway yards. Normally we would have attacked at low altitude, but we were told scatter your bombs from a higher altitude. Accuracy doesn't matter. The Germans are panicking and just a few explosions in the railway yard will send them running. So he said we attacked, we dropped our bombs. We left. We were told that many of the trainloads of Germans left without fully loading up their trains. Later, we learned that this railway yard was next to the Auschwitz concentration camps, and the intention had been to load up prisoners aboard those trains and take them away before we could liberate them. And of all of the missions I flew, if that is true, that is the most important and the one that I'm most proud of. So when they reached Auschwitz, by then the SS had fled. They had left just a few guards there. They'd marched away most of the prisoners. Most of those who were left were people who were too weak to take to the roads. Many had been massacred. Others were due to be killed, but the SS had left before they could do so. And the Soviet troops were just greeted by these scenes of utter horror, something that they had just, you know, it was beyond their worst imagination. And towards the end of the first day of the liberation, one of the company commanders of the Soviet troops who had entered the camp came up to his regiment commander and just said, Comrade Major, we have to leave. The men can't take any more of this. We need to move on. And, you know, these are soldiers who have been through the most appalling battles and seen the most terrible casualties. And yet, for them, this was just something that was unendurable.
And I mean, you're speaking with a lot of heart and a lot of compassion. How much is this book an emotive book? And how much is it just sort of an account of strategy and plan and, you know, experiences?
Yeah, I try very hard not to write sterile accounts of, you know, arrows on maps and flags moving left and right, because there are plenty of accounts like that. I try to show a mixture both of the thinking of those at higher levels, the thinking of those at middle levels, and the ordinary people on the ground, whether they are civilians caught up in the fighting, whether they are prisoners in these appalling conditions, or whether they're just the soldiers on each side struggling somehow to stay alive. Everybody knows by now that the end of the war must be close. And then there's the question of, so why do you then carry on fighting? And from the German point of view, they know full well just how badly they behaved in the Soviet Union, and they know that the Soviets are going to inflict a terrible revenge upon German families when they get to Germany. So they're fighting to hold the Soviets off as long as they can, in the desperate hope that most of Germany can surrender to the Americans and British rather than to the Red Army. For the Soviets, you know, they have this problem that these are people who have survived terrible battles, suffered huge casualties. It's understandable people start thinking about self-preservation. So the Soviet political officers make the most of episodes like the Auschwitz liberation, the liberation of former Red Army prisoners of war that the Germans have been holding, in order to keep the soldiers motivated, to keep them fighting to the very, very end. And I think this is an important factor of it. You know, you can't motivate men to fight bitterly to the last ounce of their energy, to the last drop of blood, and then when the other side raises their hands, to behave as if everything is like a football match and the referee has blown the whistle and that everything has to stop. You know, you cannot turn off the violence that rapidly. You just have to accept that that's, you know, part and parcel of the price of war.
Yes, it is actually sometimes one of the hardest things to stomach, actually, after that whistle has been blown, seeing some of the terrible things in various places. And finally, at least from me, what was the impact of this campaign thereafter? You know, what happened? How did it end? How did it leave things?
So by the end of the battle, the Red Army has reached the line of the Oder River to the east of Berlin, about 45, 40 miles from the outskirts of Berlin. They even have a couple of little bridgeheads over the river. Further south, they have occupied the Neisse line. So you're very close to the modern eastern borders of Germany. And it's worth remembering that in 1945, that means a lot of German territory, which has now been annexed or now been incorporated into Poland, for example, a lot of that German territory is now in Soviet hands. So there are German civilians living under Soviet rule. Many have fled. For the first time, the Germans have had to experience columns of refugees fleeing the advancing enemy, something that they had inflicted upon other countries earlier on in the war. But the Germans are now struggling once more to try to restore their front line. In the West, things are going disastrously wrong. The British and Americans are advancing across the Rhine, advancing into Germany. Everybody knows that the end of the war is close, but, you know, Berlin remains, and there are still enough diehards in Germany to make sure that this is going to go down to the very, very bitterest of ends.
Yeah, well, thank you. Like I said, that was my last question, but I would like to know if there's anything else that you feel like we've missed or that you feel like would be important to add before we start wrapping things up.
I think I'd like to finish just where we started, which is that, you know, you and I both heard stories of this war from people who experienced it. And I think we are seeing across the world at the moment that Memories seem to survive one generation, and then as soon as that generation starts to die out, it's almost as if we forget some of the lessons that that previous generation had learned. And I think it is important to study history just to remind ourselves of what happened in the past, in the hope that actually we can be wise enough not to repeat those mistakes again.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for your time this morning. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. That was Aprit Buttar, or Buttar, B-U-T-T-A-R, if you want to look it up. And his book is called Into the Reich, The Red Army's Advance to the Oder in 1945. You can find it on Amazon or the Talk Radio Europe bookshop. Aprit, thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much.